kind of made to mimic a...
It's beautiful.
A flame. Well, I used up the last of the grenadine.
Oh.
So, if okay. you know, you out there in podcast land can get an impression on how masculine our drinks are. Grenadine, it makes any drink drinkable. I totally fucked this drink up. I had grenadine. Oh, it's good. It tastes like candy now.
Grenadine and vodka. Yeah. We made something fantastic.
It's like cough syrup.
All right.
It is now.
I turn to you.
We're going to be a little bit off kilter, I think. A, Mako just woke up from a nap, and B, I had some cough syrup earlier tonight, and I'm mixing it with booze. So who knows what's going to happen? Because it's RPG Afterglow. Hey. Where the dice get rolled, the story gets told, and we ponder the significance. I'm Jake.
And I'm Mako.
And we have a session of massive proportions, not so much in the scale of what we did, but in what we encountered.
There was
a first for every adventuring party, and we got there. What could it be? Yeah. Stay tuned.
Just starting off, did we rest? I think we did. We rested because
We finished up the last session despite Boddington's greatest efforts to be effective in combat, i.e. cause immeasurable wakes of destruction.
Right.
Regarding the device at the top of the tower.
Yep.
This island has two towers, you know, make no parallels to Lord of the Rings, but this one had a device at the top of it surrounded by this glass structure where we could look out and kind of have certain points magnified and just basically kind of like a top of a lighthouse sort of a thing. We had this encounter with these constructs that followed us in through the gateway. Boddington blew up the majority of it. But nevertheless, we got the thing
to work,
kicking and creaking and screaming to work, and it caused this light beam to shoot out and meet the other tower. And then from that, this kind of rib cage effect, if you imagine two towers, a beam of light between them, and then all these other beams kind of emanating from the central beam.
And it fanned out and went around. Basically, it really looks like it goes around the entire island.
And what is it doing? I don't know. And that's kind of where we started the session, like going, okay, what's going on with this thing? It's, you know, this power is going on around us. What could it mean? What could it be doing?
To begin with, Violet had an opportunity to expend that fifth level spell that she had, the scrying.
Oh, but before that, you finally got to use your spear.
I did.
In the most effective way that Violet could see fit.
Well, for some reason, Tobias came to the conclusion that this beam of light was possibly a walkway.
It was a transport, or a bridge. Wolfie, of course, with his blink blink. All right. How are you going to test that theory?
Do you touch it?
You know, I do remember Schlegel kind of was like, maybe I will stick something else in there.
And so I stuck my spear in there and it took the first part of it off and just vaporized.
Yeah, it's like basically throwing a stick into a torch.
Yeah.
Like a high pressure torch just going, all right, there goes my spear.
And then so, of course, I threw the rest of it. But you know what's great about that is that Tobias still believed it was somehow a transport or a walkway.
Right.
Although he did witness the spear being destroyed.
Right.
Maybe not the maybe sharpest tool in the box. I don't know.
Before you got into scrying, I did get a little bit into my own, as far as I could go anyway, with Boddington's knowledge arcana checks, you know, kind of looking at this thing, scratching my head, going, what could it be about? I mean, I could understand the machine that got it operating and how to get that whole thing to work from the controls over on the one side to this device that was aimed up to meet with the other tower. And I rolled pretty well, and Wolfie described it basically in the sense that it's just intense magical power. For all purposes, this is a part of it. He equated it to starting the motor, starting the engine. This thing's running now.
Yeah.
What else could be going on around it? I don't know. And I think that's kind of what fed into your scrying.
Yeah, so I went into the scrying and I scryed on Nibar. And that, you know,
who we were aware he was kind of off on another island.
Right. Right.
We saw his boat.
And that was actually very useful and very interesting because I was able to pick up a lot of information. He told us that they were on an island and they were actually making a device work and that they were going to go to a different island where the well is.
Yeah, we just activated this tower and Nibar, from what you were scrying in on his conversation, his immediate ambitions was to activate this well.
Yeah. And he didn't think much of the tower. He was like, okay, well, they've activated, but, you know, it seems as though the tower may not have as a huge significance as what he was up to.
Right. Or he might be a super savvy villain that is always paranoid that he might be scried upon and is trying to downplay something that is perhaps significant.
Maybe.
Those fools.
And then he did bring up, he has a lord. Lord
Dolomitius. Dolomitius.
Thank you for another simple name.
Yeah.
Dolomitius. God. All right. So I will not ever remember that. So it's Dolomitius.
Well, that's why I like how you have like very finite amount of post-its on your character sheet. And one of them is solely dedicated to that name. Like that name is going, it's important. So somehow, somewhere it's going to be the yellow post-it in the middle of my sheet that I will not freaking lose.
But somehow Dolomitius was talking about an island that appears, and that this island is appearing in a couple of weeks, and it's a very important island that Nevar is going to try to get to. Apparently there's something there. And the elves are hanging out on their own little island with their 25 boats of death and destruction. And if we just avoid them, we're doing okay.
Right. And that's been reiterated, I think, every session that we've been on these islands. Like, the elves, don't fuck with them. All right?
Just leave them alone.
Okay.
I think we should fuck with them.
Yeah. I really mean, between, you know, one gnome to another.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost like he's telling us what to do.
We need to go over there
and
try to make peace with him or something. Yeah. Or I don't know.
But with this sort of reveal of kind of a bigger plot scope, at least it concerns our villain, it was definitely not subtly reiterated that, okay, in the amount of time that you both will be waiting for this island to appear, Nevar will be waiting, and since you're on Nevar's ass, you're going to be waiting for it too, because that's where you're going to hopefully try to intercept him, that this would be a good window before this island appears to level up.
Go back to town.
Right.
Where all leveling up happens.
Exactly. Yeah. Where just the magic realm of just acquiring new skills takes place. You know, here we are still within the first half hour or so of our session. Mm-hmm. I mean, it almost makes me wonder, what if you didn't scry? What if you didn't choose to do that? Would we still be kind of in this blind realm of eternally seventh level? Yeah. I don't know. But we got a nice little inside scoop. I'm sure we'll be able to take in some.
Honestly, I don't think so. Because if you don't recall, there was a point where Steve was just not getting, we have to go to the other tower.
Yeah.
Somehow we have to walk over to the other tower.
Yeah.
And Wimpy was like, this is a two-part dungeon.
And part of it is getting from one tower to the next.
Yeah.
I mean, Steve was asking for this beam of light to be a transport to the other tower as much as Nicole was asking every piece of land to be forest.
It is funny. Like,
you can ask as much as you want, but it's not going to make a difference.
There's just sometimes where he just like focuses and he's like, this is how it is. And this is what I was like, no, it's really not, man. Yeah. But all right. So Wubby hit him over the head with a metagame pan.
Yeah, or what I've heard called a clue by four.
So I don't know. If we didn't figure out to leave this island, I think maybe another clue by four would have struck us in the head somehow.
Yeah.
We need to go home. So we got ourselves ready and
making our way off to the other tower.
Yeah, we decided to cross country across the center of the island. Through like
I think Taro and George kind of got a good bird's eye view of the island, and we're able to kind of, with survival rolls and their insight, be able to figure out that it's about a day's travel from this point to that point, even including the bogging down of the swamp.
Right.
No pun intended.
Well, but Violet had her, so she put mage armor on and she got her mount. Why walk when you can ride?
Especially through a swamp, you'll get your shoes dirty.
Exactly. So she was concerned about that. I got on the pony and rode over. And then you guys had to walk.
Right. But I'm kind of splashing along. I don't mind. Yeah. I mean, all my stuff is
you're happy.
Made to be messy.
You're happy in the mud for some reason. I don't know.
Yeah. Again, it's probably a little degrading from your point of view, but we're having a great time.
I don't know. I'm sure some gnomes like to get dirty. But it's important for me to humiliate Tobias when I can.
It's the great balancing factor.
Exactly. But we did get to a point.
About the halfway point between these two towers. And right in the middle there is this boggy swamp area. And we're attracted by this gazebo.
Yes. It was a stone gazebo.
Yes. In the middle of a swamp.
Yes.
I'm sure this is some sort of an attraction that couldn't possibly pose any danger.
Well, remember, and it was surrounded by lanterns.
Yes.
The lanterns were kind of dirty and they'd been there for a long time.
But they were still burning?
No, I don't think they were.
Okay.
No, it was just a ring of lanterns around it. That's a good question. I never actually knew.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but whenever we've been in quote-unquote delves and there's been quote-unquote lanterns in any sort of delve dungeon area, they've always at least for the most part, been kind of like, oh yeah, they're burning still, magically burning. Like, it's kind of one of these go-tos. Like,
yeah.
Sure, from the DM point of view, it might just be like, hey, you can save your light sources and this is just fine and don't worry about it. But, you know, on the other side, it's like, it's kind of unconventional to see lanterns that aren't lit. Even though it totally makes sense in the middle of a swamp and they've been sitting here forever.
Yeah.
But so it is. It's daylight. It's middle of the day anyway, right. So we don't really need them for a source of light.
So we didn't actually get that far.
This was a moment where it was battle map time. Mm-hmm. The poster board was out and the gazebo was right in the middle.
Yeah.
And all sorts of various swamp and wolfy colored in squares, blue to be water and green to be kind of mucky and half movement. And water could mean anything from half movement to deep enough to have to swim through. So he's coloring this all in, and we're coming upon this area from one of the corners.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're still kind of a distance off, moving in cautiously, moving in slowly, and at some point, a hissing is heard.
Yeah.
And this was kind of the appetizer for the evening.
And we were attacked by snakes. I think they were snakes.
Yeah, first it was one, lunged at Magnus.
Yeah.
And then immediately in response, Taro and George take to the skies. And another one comes out of the gazebo. Tobias unleashes a spiritual weapon, which in typical Tobias fashion misses. Mm-hmm. But hey, you know, it's a Lunit's thing. And you unleash your snapdragons.
Right.
I thought it was kind of neat how fluent it was that you were still up on your mount.
Yeah.
You and Wolfie both knew, which I really wasn't aware of. And that's kind of part of what impressed me, how, you know, you immediately wanted to get off the mount and go into your snapdragon thing, but it required a ride check to get off of your mount as a free action, right?
Right.
Yeah, so you guys communicated that rather fluently, and you failed your roll, but still were able to move and then cast these snapdragons.
And even though you fail, it doesn't mean that you fall off your horse. It just means that it becomes a move action.
Yeah, it's so. Just like you couldn't quite flip off and land.
Yeah.
You're just like, oh shit, my foot's stuck, and you're okay, now we're good, okay, boom, down.
Mm-hmm.
It takes you 3 seconds instead of one.
Right. That's what's fun about the mound, is that you're doing those things. And I think she'll always keep on trying to do that as a free action.
Yeah, and I think one of these days you will succeed.
I think so.
You've always succeeded when I've put you in a point of humiliation. And this wasn't a point of humiliation. Either you'd get off quickly, or you'd get off not as quickly, but you wouldn't be humiliated.
Yeah.
So I think you need those stakes in order to succeed on your dice roll.
I think so.
But then at that point, initiative is rolled, combat unfolds, mm-hmm. and I think we all hear, at least I know I hear, and at least I was the one that reacted to, whispering coming from the gazebo. Cries for help.
Well, no, the whispering
from a female voice
was right in the midst of us, saying we need help. Yeah,
right. Because
spell message, and it was like right in the center of us, saying, "You know, please help me. I'm in the gazebo."
I took the bait anyway.
Well, obviously, yeah. But we fought. We fought these snakes.
Taro was up in the sky, able to shoot some of her magical bolts.
Mm-hmm.
Magnus, of course, does the big damage,
right.
Takes out the first snake.
Yeah.
I take one of my mutagens, increasing my hit points because it's the constitution boosting one.
Yep.
And I'm still kind of fixated on the call of distress from the gazebo. You're sending your snapdragons out from the recently killed snake to the new one.
Yep.
And yeah, we make short work of these snakes.
Yes.
And that's why I kind of called it the appetizer, because it was, you know, part of it was this fear, this dread going into the swamps, because if you can recall from last sessions and whatnot, there was plenty of foreshadowing with this cry going off in the distance. And from my knowledge, nature, I was able to, I think it was nature. I knew there was a black dragon out there
Wolfie
somewhere.
Was giving it to you in nature, but it shouldn't be. It's knowledge magic, actually. Our knowledge, our
because dragons aren't really natural.
They're magical beasts.
Yeah.
And well, that, you know, and the thing
I
is
think
that,
to his ends, he wanted to kind of
help
foreshadow
you
and
right,
cause this fear. But
and that's why I was kind of holding off on my bigger spells. You know, I was doing the snapdragons. I did the micro meteorites on it and so forth. But I was not really using any of my bigger spells.
Yeah. And I think the combat with the two snakes took about 2 to 3 rounds.
Right. Right.
So now, you know, anybody that has an inkling of metagaming in them will know that this is only leading up into something else.
Right.
We're not gathering around the table here for 2-3 rounds of combat against two snakes, and that's the extent of our dice rolling for the night.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we moved towards the gazebo. Some of you guys went really quickly.
Well, not me, because I'm a gnome, and even though I was the first one to make my way towards the gazebo, I was the last one to get there.
Yeah.
But my legs are short.
Tobias got there and looked inside and saw that it was very clean and white inside.
Carved benches.
Yeah. And that there was
constellations on the ceiling.
Constellation on the ceiling. And that there was like a fire urn in the center.
Yep. And right at that point, Taro and George had some trouble hovering and they kind of came crashing down to the land. Hey, all right, we're checking out this gazebo.
She really needs to stop trying to show up. I don't know. She likes hovering all the time.
Yeah. Practice makes perfect.
I guess so.
But, if you're a stubborn halfling, at least.
Yeah. But fell to the earth because the poor owl can't hover for that long.
And Magnus gets there with a, what you doing?
Yeah. And then you got there and then I rode my horse up.
And I'm kind of playing up my whole fear, paranoia with this dragon thing. Like, he could be anywhere. He's going to be here anywhere. So while you guys are checking out the gazebo, I'm just focusing on my perception to be like, okay, where is he going to pop up? What's going on? I thought it would just be like a good spot to have Boddington just be kind of on edge. Too much coffee. I don't know.
Violet looks in and sees that possibly what we're looking at inside this gazebo is an illusion. It was at that point that we met our main adversary for the evening.
Yeah, I'm playing up my perception rolls, and I notice some ripples going off kind of on the other side of the gazebo, off in the water, because, you know, this is just like a lone island where this gazebo is standing, and there's swamp, watery muck all going on all around it. And so I see some ripples going on. I'm the first one to see, again, still playing up my fear that I just am unable to scream, unable to warn you guys because I'm just frozen. Coming up from the muck and the mire is a black dragon. Mm-hmm. Not a full-fledged black dragon. Well, it was, I don't know the different ranks of it, but...
Well, it was large in size, and so it was definitely a young adult.
Okay.
So the first action that it takes is to spit.
Do its acid.
And its breath weapon is the spit acid, which is a straight line for 120 feet of acid.
And incidentally, all of us gathered and kind of paranoid, fearful to enter this gazebo, or more or less lined up at the entrance. Yeah, right outside this gazebo.
Besides Violet.
Besides you, of course.
Violet was not, so she was on the side of you guys.
Yeah, I think that's just great how every time this sort of a massive party damage thing happens, somehow Violet's like, oh, look at you. Oh, boy, that must have hurt.
Oops.
Yeesh. So, you guys okay?
And it did hurt. You guys took quite a bit of damage.
I made my reflex save, but it was still bad news. I do remember right at the onset of this black dragon appearing, this black dragon spouting out its acid stream, and all of us having to make a will save. It was a will save against being frightened. And
we all failed.
We all failed, and...
Some of us did.
Even so... I don't know how much Wolfie was aware of what frightened is or if he recalled at that point. I wouldn't say he nerfed it for the sake. He basically realized the horrible finitude of time and realized that if the majority of the party is running away, this combat's going to drag on and on.
It's kind of part of the problem with the frightened effect. The frightened effect makes you flee. And
just get out.
I've nerfed it too because of the fact that to have you guys completely flee is just a disaster.
In the same sense that splitting up the party is just bad news, this is just, it just slows it down.
Yeah, it's like everyone goes off in their own direction.
And it takes another three rounds to bring them back because, of course, they're running off at full tilt.
It's a fundamental problem. I mean, I remember experiencing it once in Sligo's world where we come across ghosts. And we get the fear effect, and we all just run. And it's really hard when you all run, because then it's like, well, how many rounds am I running? You're running for 4 rounds.
Yeah, I mean,
as far as you can. In
the setting that we were in here with the swamp, sure, we're going to be slowed down by the swamp a little bit, but it's not going to take long for all of us to be off the map in our own separate directions.
Yeah, I haven't really delved that deep into it, but I don't know if, like, in next round you get to make another saving throw against it. But I think it's like you are afraid for this many rounds.
Well, it obviously makes sense, and it's a mechanic that, you know, has a place. Reading it on paper, going, oh yeah, that's, wow, this is pretty badass for this monster to be able to do that.
Yeah.
But then only in practice do you kind of realize, oh wow, when this many people fail it, and then suddenly where's my combat?
Where'd everyone go?
This party set up, and everyone ran away. It's like, you got to fight the monster? What's going on?
Because I can just think of better things for fear to be. It's like, let's say that fear is that you have a -4 on your initiative.
Yeah.
Because you're hesitating because you're so afraid.
Yeah.
Or, you know, along with like a major minus on your attacks and your saves and so forth, that would be kind of a better penalty.
It's just a very severe penalty to just say, you book it.
Yeah.
Away.
And because, you know, there was a time that it was like, there was a fear effect going, trying to get into a particular haunted mansion of Schlegel's, and my character Blondie, he kept running away and he kept running away, and I couldn't get over it.
Yeah,
I
could became not, comedic.
It was just like, it was just
ridiculous. All right, whoa! Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Still scared me. Okay. It still scared me.
No, you know? I know there's a ghost behind this wall or this door, and I'm going to, oh, God, again.
And that's kind of one of the problems with saving throws is, like, you can just have a bad night of rolling.
And that could be a brick wall.
And it's just a brick wall. And everyone else is, like, waiting on their side. Blondie couldn't get in. You know, they were starting to sneak around. I'm just trying to get in, but I'm so afraid I can't get in.
Yeah.
And so it's like, this is kind of absurd.
In the mechanical sense, the party's there, ready to proceed. Mm-hmm. And one member is unable to meet them. And it's based on a die roll, whether it's fear or whether it's like you just can't make your climb roll to get up the wall to meet them. Guess what? The party's going to throw it on a rope. And you're going to get up there and we're going to move on.
Yeah.
But, you know, with this fear thing, it's like, there's nothing we can do to help you. We can, like, encourage you and try to, maybe next time you try, like, actually tie a rope around you so you run away, we just lasso you back in. But it's like, you know, there comes a point where the mechanics become that, a mechanic, and cease to be, you know, something that actually colors the story or the atmosphere and the environment.
And, you know, I really got to give props to Woofie to be able to read that and go, no, that's not what I want.
He downgraded it to just shaken. So we are taking those penalties.
We're taking penalties and so forth, and that's fine, yeah, because it's like, I felt like some of the events that happened in, you know, in the campaign with Blondie, there's a point where as a DM, you just got to go, you know what, you got over it.
Yeah, but that's the eternal responsibility of a dungeon master is to know and understand the rules to be able to execute them, but also have the sensibilities to know that, hey, wait, this is panning out to be more than it needs to be. Whatever it is, to be able to kind of interject and not be blindly following.
Right.
Well, this is how the rules work. This is how it should happen.
And it will happen this way every time.
Every time.
Yeah, you know, it's like, maybe he gets over it. You know, the second time he gets his courage back and he gets it there. And you get just to have to say, it's like, well, you're shaken, but you get to move forward.
Yeah.
That's a great way to go about it.
Right.
You know,
you got over it and you realize you have to stick with your party, but you're just on edge. You're just not focused.
Yeah, you're tweaked. Yeah.
Exactly.
But anyway, so.
Yeah, so where were we?
Well, I mean, we got the fear effect, and a lot of us did have that fear effect.
I did, I know.
I did too, which is kind of disappointing. I thought it'd be great if Violet wasn't afraid, but she was.
Yeah.
And she was like, this dragon's bigger than I was expecting. This is a little too much. Magnus was not.
I think Magnus might have been the only one.
Magnus might have been the only one, or Taro might have gotten away with it too. I can't remember.
I know that Taro sent George off to, you know,
get
away from the danger.
Yeah.
Thumbs up to that, because we're always giving Nicole guffer, you know.
The Isle could take in a dragon.
Yeah, you know, just roll a 20 eight times in a row.
You know, and it was, I think right now is a good time to just like, it's a dragon. We got to fight a dragon. To fight a dragon is like awesome.
Yeah. And I think we're 7th level, we're ready for that scale of,
sort of,
badassness. Yeah. I mean, sure, it was a younger dragon. It wasn't like the full-fledged Dungeons and Dragons, heroes, dragon, fire, but, brimstone, blah. But
you shouldn't go, oh, it was a young dragon. It's not that. No, a young dragon is so horrible.
And that's what I learned, because, I mean, I've never dealt with a dragon as a DM. I've never really looked at
the mechanics
and what the actual entry is in the Monster Manual or the Bestiary now.
But it was funny because, I mean, I, you know, when he set down a medium-sized creature and he was telling me I'm like, okay, I recognize that we're working with a young dragon. I mean, I recognize that what it was. But what is interesting is as we kept going on, I was like, well, wait a minute. A young dragon actually can still do quite a bit.
Yeah.
The suggestion spell was from the young dragon, from this black dragon, because they can cast a spell.
You mean that request, that call for help?
It was a message. It was a message spell. It was a rouge. From that point, we shook initiative. I don't know if any of us beat the dragon. Did you beat the dragon? I didn't beat the dragon.
I did.
I shook like crap.
I was able to do one thing, and that was use one of my new third level extracts.
Okay.
I, for the first time ever, kind of was saving for what I was fearful of happening, and that's this dragon. And that was this extract called Draconic Reservoir.
Oh, okay, yeah.
To put it simply, it's another one of those elemental extracts where I choose an element. It's like resist energy, except that not only do I resist it, but I absorb it. up to a point of, I think it's 6 hit points times my caster level. So that's 42 hit points for me. It caps off at 42, however much I take each round or however in whatever increments I take. But then I can deal that elemental damage back via a melee weapon, which I don't really see Boddington doing. I thought maybe I could give it to Manchester and he could be able to do it. But it's only 1d6 anyway. But for all intents and purposes, it's like just being able to absorb that amount of whatever. And so, right, of course, yeah, I take it and select acid because being able to shake off 42 hit points of acid damage, which will inevitably be coming, would be a good thing. So that's what I do.
Yeah, I didn't get much of a chance to do anything. I was
because it promptly cast darkness.
Yep, I love darkness.
It was the beginning of the Mako Rage for the evening.
There's no Mako Rage. There is. I hate darkness.
Yeah.
But, well, the problem with darkness is all of my spells are via sight.
Yeah. And you need line of sight.
And the range of darkness is huge.
Yeah.
It's so
big. Which we got
big
to see with that big demon guy when we were in the shadow plane.
Yeah, yeah. So for Violet, it's just like, this is a drag.
And especially because with the demon guy in the shadow plane, you could kind of skirt around and get outside the range of the darkness,
yeah,
conceivably. But this thing was in the middle of a swamp. So it's just like trudging through half movement, right, swamp, right, and who knows where you're going to fall into some water. So like you can't hope to skirt around this, yeah, darkness thing now.
And at that point I had gotten off my mount, so I'm like screwed because I had gotten off my mount.
Your shoes are now dirty.
No, they never got dirty.
Oh, okay.
I made quite certain of that. But
because you
at this point, then it's, we all, it worked out beautifully because what it did do, it made us all just split to the wind.
Tara
went one direction. Magnus went a different direction.
It was almost like Wolfie had our perception checks work against us.
Yeah.
Because Wolfie, informed Magnus matter-of-factly that, hey, you heard the dragon take off in this direction.
Yep.
But then you don't know what's going on over here, George. Or no, George flew off. But yeah, he was kind of giving mixed messages to everybody. And so everybody's following their own impulse,
yep,
in the darkness. So it definitely captured that element of just being totally blind in the dark.
So Magnus comes out of the darkness and was able to see the dragon. The black dragon sees Magnus, and we learn quickly how dangerous a dragon is. A dragon has a breath weapon, that's great. And a dragon has
little manipulative spells that are great too.
And dragon has spells, and the dragon can fly. But when a dragon hits and it pounced on her, the amount of attacks is what really starts to make him really dangerous.
Yeah.
Especially in melee.
Can we recall what it was?
It can do a bite. It can do two claws. It can do two wings. And it can do its tail. That's a lot in one hit. And that's exactly what Magnus got.
Yeah.
In one hit.
Yeah.
It pounced and this dragon's not missing.
If I am recalling correctly, Magnus did crit it. And it was a very brilliantly placed crit. But even so, it was that in that whole, I remember in one of our past episodes, Megan was talking about how, okay, Magnus has this many hit points, he can do this much damage, and the monster that I'm fighting can do this much damage, but has this many hit points. The way that it, has kind of worked out up until recently is that Magnus just does more damage than the monster can incur, so that, sure, she would be threatened after 2 or 3 rounds of this amount of damage, but she takes that monster out before it can. And now it's kind of the tables are turned, where all of a sudden this thing that has, what, 5 attacks? The majority of them are hitting. It's kind of like you get those 2-3 rounds of dangerous damage all packed into one
when
it's there in melee.
I mean, because it's hitting on a dime.
As we can tie in kind of the rest of what else is going on outside of this, my reaction to the darkness is to kind of swim in the direction of where I'm hearing violence going on. So I start moving from the gazebo to that direction. Little did I know that what is in between myself and the source of the noise, i.e. Magnus and this dragon fighting, is a decent stretch, about 20 feet of swamp, some of which I have to swim through,
right,
and some of which is polluted with this dragon's acid. So thank goodness I took my draconic reservoir.
Right.
So I'm swimming through this, and Wolfie gives me a reflex save, and of course I fail it. I end up taking 40 hit points of acid damage. Now, as I was saying before, I get 42 of this reservoir. So as these rounds are panning out, I'm about halfway through this stretch of acid swamp muck trying to get to my homie Magnus to help him out, and I've taken 40 hit points of acid damage. Oh my god. You know, this is just we haven't really done much of anything. I mean, Magnus got a crit in. We're already just like utterly humiliated as a party of heroes that we're used to being.
Yeah.
And it's just this one dragon.
Realizing I was going the wrong direction, I decided to fly. And so I tried to fly straight up. And once again, the dice did not roll in my favor.
It's the darkness's fault.
Yeah.
Once again.
Yeah. And so I had to fly up in an incline that reduced my speed. So it took quite a bit of time before I was able to get over there. And in that time, I think Magnus was able to get a couple of more good swings in, but it's not enough to really hurt the dragon. And the dragon was quickly making hamburger out of Magnus.
Yeah. It brought Magnus down right about the same time that Tobias was blindly throwing out sound bursts in the darkness.
And that's where we learned of its other grand quality of a dragon is it has spell resistance.
Yes.
And if you fail the spell resistance, your spell is not...
The dragon doesn't give a shit about your magic.
I think the sound burst actually he did was able to damage it, but I don't think he was able to stun it.
Yeah, and right about this time, I'm pulling myself up out of the muck because I take one more round of this acid damage. I make my reflex save on the second time around, but still it ends up being like 18 more acid damage, and I have two left over, so like I'm taking a good amount of damage here, and I finally get to this island to find that Magnus has now been dropped. And so it's me and this dragon and a tree. I definitely utilized that proximity in seeing the rest of you guys kind of like come to Magnus's aid and try to bring Magnus back to life as I'm kind of dancing around trying to keep this tree between the dragon and I, because even when I first came out of the muck, it was able to get an attack of opportunity in on me because it has this unreal reach. I mean, everything was more or less stacked against us. Everything that we've ever faced as a strong point in the monster, this dragon had.
Yeah. One of the first things I did after that, as you guys got hit by the first initial breath weapon, was I cast invisibility on myself.
You're flying around unbeknownst to the dragon, as far as we know.
You're right. I came out of the darkness and I saw that Magnus was out cold. So I went down there. I got there, Tobias got there, and Taro got there. So all of us were there to resuscitate Magnus back to life.
And at that point, I was able to kind of dance behind the tree enough to get a healing potion down.
Mm-hmm.
And between the constitution bonus that I had for my mutagen, the draconic reservoir that allowed me to absorb the acid damage, and the healing potion that I just took. At that point, I was down to 7 hit points, and I had absorbed 138. I did the math. I had absorbed 138 hit points of damage.
Wow.
One of these things were just like, at least in this instance, this is where you can kind of tweak the alchemist to be able to stand his ground.
Right, yeah.
And take a shit ton of damage and still be scared shitless, which at least Boddington was.
Well, at that point, I think Tobias casted that bless spell, the one that you get the altered...
The blessing of fever or whatever it is, where you can choose from a smorgasbord of awesome shit.
Right, yeah. Which was really good because that really helped us out to figure things what we wanted.
But there's a certain range within that. Yeah. And not everybody was included in that.
You were not included.
I was not included.
Yeah.
At this particular moment, I mean, at least for me, Jake, as a player at the table and not having any exposure of being a DM of a dragon, but the majority of my interaction with dragons has been mostly role-playing. I think one of the biggest, most memorable initial dragon interactions was with Wolfie's first campaign.
Right.
Where we're doing this whole, I mean, it was within the first couple of sessions, and it was one of my first initial sessions too. This is the first campaign I've played in, one of the first sessions, and it's this whole, I guess, to make a long story short, this villain, recurring villain Stuger, runs off with this thing, the MacGuffin, and somehow we end up with it, and it turns out to be something that's precious to a dragon. I'm new to the table, new to this whole experience, so I'm letting you guys kind of run what to do with it, and you decide to lie to this dragon, and I'll never forget how you guys, you, Mako, and Steve, were just fumbling, stuttering, nervous idiots. Talking to Wolfgang. But it was different because it was you playing these characters talking to a dragon that was like, where is my thing? And you're like, you know, hands behind your back with this thing and it doesn't know you have this thing. Going, he went that way. So this whole experience was like, whoa, Drake. I mean, just to see you guys getting that nervous over this imaginary dragon thing. But then fast forwarding to now and having a small, you know, mercifully pared down version of what that was to have us fight, there's a certain inherent sense of combat scale, at least from this campaign. It's been kind of, every DM has kind of his own deal, but at least from our combat interactions with Wolfie is that there's a certain scale of rounds. And once it gets to that point, it starts to wind down and it runs away or it gets killed or we get done and it's fine. And, you know, we go on and there's like, you know, nothing more than like 3-4 rounds, I would suppose. But this was just one where at this moment where Magnus goes down and I'm hiding behind the tree and we're all kind of gathering still. It's just like, how much more is left in this dragon?
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, I still have some tricks up my sleeve, but I'll run out of those and it could still keep going. Like this is, I have no sense of scale with this thing. This is scary for Boddington because I've been playing it up that way, but also kind of scary for me.
And I mean, at the, you know, in that too, it's like, it shot another breath weapon at us and I got hit with that ass. So we did quite a bit of damage on that. Then I tried casting my highest level spell at Lightning Bolt, and it failed to get over the damage reduction. And that was like, oh my God.
Yeah, and the rage incurs.
Well, and then I tried again, and it failed to do it again. So, I mean, at this point, it's just like, my highest level spells are not doing any effect, and people are just like dying left and right.
Which I appreciate Boddington does, because you seem to be invested in what the fate of our party here. Like, you, the fact that you're frustrated means that you care.
And Violet was frustrated. I think Violet was frustrated that her spells are not working.
Right, but the pessimistic side of Boddington looking at Violet would be like, oh, she would try something and go, oh, that didn't work. I wonder why. And go into the scientific frame of mind with no sense of the consequences that people will die and where everybody's in danger. Right, and bad shit's going to happen to the rest of us. That to see you frustrated is like, all right, gee, I don't know. Like, it comforted Boddington, even though he's like scared out of his mind too.
Because you're almost near death too. Tobias was able to get in there and keep us alive.
Yeah.
And I think in there, too, that Tara was able to get some of his arrows in.
And Tobias even lined up a solid power attack.
Yeah.
It was kind of funny how the narrative panned out there, where there was a bunch of bonuses and penalties going on. And, you know, when the first roll came out, Schlegel announced the armor class hit. Wolfie was like, oh, he just blocks it with his wing. But then we realized we had this bonus. And I was like, oh, it just rips through his wing. Oh, but then we realized we had this penalty. Oh, but he blocks it with his wing. And then, you know, it ended up hitting when all is said and done. But it was just kind of funny for all of us to go, wait, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes.
There were a lot of things going against us there.
Yeah.
Realizing my spells are not working, I use a Pearl of Summing. So I sent down a large Earth Elemental to get in there and do some swinging.
Yeah, and I do remember you placed the miniature rather aggressively, like, fucking yeah. Just because the whole evening was coming up to this point of just like, you know what? This is the last trick I got.
Yep. And so set it down.
You better fucking work.
And of course, I still was shaking terrible. And I could easily hit with that large elemental, but I couldn't shake above a 10. It was a bad night for Violet.
Sometimes that happens.
But him being in there was able, you guys were able to surround it, which gave you a bonus to the attacks. And I think Magnus was able to get in there and do another good couple of hits.
Yep.
And that was enough to get the dragon to just split the scene.
Yeah, it was kind of one of those, like, what's the ink? The octopus ink.
Yeah.
This burst of mist, and we're all just kind of blinded by it, but it does that to make its getaway. And between you and Magnus, you're still, like, eyes on the prize.
Well, Violet chased it for a while and fired another lightning bolt at it.
You took out your fireball wand even, didn't you?
Yeah, but I fired another lightning bolt, and it missed. The evening ended with her...
You pouting.
Yeah,
that's the last note I have in my book here.
She just sat down on the top of the gazebo and just pouted. Because it was very... It's very frustrating that magic failed her. Because magic never fails Violet.
It's I almost look at it as like a bard being deafened.
Yeah.
That Violet having no line of sight for her spells is like, you just take away that sensory facility.
Yeah.
And everything kind of falls apart for what she wants to do for the party.
And it made her really think. It was funny because Meg and Nicole were saying, it's like, well, Violet hates dragons. And it's like, I don't, and it's like, and I had to think, it's like, I never think that Violet would just hate something, but Violet really truly goes, this is an adversary that I am unprepared to deal with.
And I think the hate isn't so much to the dragon, but to the circumstance that rendered you impotent.
Yeah, like this dragon has an ability.
It's responsible for making you look I mean, not necessarily look, but like feel powerless.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean you should hate. It's almost like this is my assumption for the violent appraisal that like you would respect it, but then be obsessed with coming back later. And it's almost like the kung fu film sort of a thing. Like,
yeah.
You've beaten me. Then like the rest of the movie is the montage of him respecting that attack and learning the counterattack, yeah. And then coming back later on and going, yes. And then the whole culmination of the film or your ambitions is the dragon to go, well done. Because you have countered my dark, you know, whatever it was. Just like, that's what I see as the violent motivation.
To get the scene where the two of us had passed each other, you know.
Yeah, like, and then just the dragon goes, what was that spell? What was that spell? How could you do that without seeing me? You know.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, that would be great. but yeah, because that black dragon definitely showed her up and she was quite embarrassed by it.
But that is what I think makes great stories.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, every hero's got to be, you know,
tested.
And
we're, and you know, and it's great because it's like, bring out a dragon and now here we are. We are being tested.
Yeah.
A dragon is a great, you know, great adversary, and it's really fun because it pushed all of us to the limit of what we can do. You know, Magnus was able to get in there, but Magnus got shredded.
Yep.
And it's like, Magnus is like, I got a lot of hit points. It's like, well, it can go right through all those hit points.
Yeah.
No problem. Do you remember his armor class? It was no joke. It was like 25.
Well, I'm throwing bombs, and it still was like, oh, touch attack, 24. Oh, yeah, you just barely hit. You know,
yeah,
whatever it was.
Whoa, yeah. You know, it's really, it's really great to give us this adversary because of the fact it really pushes us to the limit of what our talents are. You know, our talents that we have become overconfident in. That's really what happened to Violet. She's become very confident in all of her attacks working.
Yeah.
And all of her attacks are very much like magic missiles.
Well,
all
and a
these
lot of your whole character concept is like nothing can really right. go wrong. No harm can come to me. It's kind of like the Violet archetype.
And to recognize is like, wait a minute, all these spells that I have are based on one fact that I'm able to get over their spell resistance. What if I can't? What else can I do? And it was just by luck that I had this pearl that summoned monsters. So
yeah,
so it's going to make her like get a little bit more diverse in what her spells that she can do,
which is perfect timing because with the whole hinting at the beginning of the session where eighth level is more or less right around the corner, it can be imagined that in the next session we will be able to level up into eighth level. And I don't know if you'll be able to focus quite on that immediately, if it'll be more kind of a ninth level, tenth level sort of an investment.
Even though dealing with this dragon and having, you know, to use summon monster, the spell that really attracted Violet is the scry.
Yeah.
That's so Violet.
Yeah.
To be able to
well,
be
what
able
about some sort of a spell that can counter darkness? Is that more of a clerical thing? Like,
I think maybe I can pick that one up. Yeah, I mean, because darkness is kind of her bane.
Yeah.
I mean, she does not like darkness.
I guess all this talk about what Violet went through and that it was frustrating for you, but at the same time, really positive, I think, to the end result of an overall arc of story, you know, in the generic kung fu sort of a sense. I'm asking you, A, for our listeners, but B, or I guess maybe B more than A, for my own sake, what sort of advice or insight can you give to a DM regarding challenging your party? And not so much like just always creating like a balanced encounter. I mean, because there's math and mechanics for that. But, you know, in this kind of a circumstance where it's like, okay, we're seventh level. We've had about 20 or so weeks of doing more or less well with what we're doing. And you as a DM want to kind of bury their face in the mud. Not TPK, not totally just take all the character sheets from everybody, but you want to bring them to a point where it is like end of episode 5 Star Wars sort of a thing, where it's like everyone survived, but they're really kind of like, whoa, we got to get our shit together before we can go back and rescue Han out of carbonite sort of a thing.
Right, yeah.
You know, like, is there kind of, I mean, I'm not looking for particulars as far as like what sort of monsters you'd put out, but like, is there like a conscious point where you're like, okay, here at this point, I've got to put these guys under for the sake of making them feel the greater realm of success later on. Like, does that ever occur, or is it kind of a random organic thing? Because every campaign that I've played in your world, there's always been a point for me as a player where I'm like, oh shit. You know, not like anything outside of just the greatness of going, wow.
I think one of my favorites ever was when I actually was able to put you guys in a position where you were going to be tortured. And having you come back and go, Tom, I've been hating you and loving you this week.
Yeah.
I'll be like, oh.
But that was a perfect example of kind of where I'm along the lines of what I'm asking.
It was pretty great. I had you guys meet up with some character, and you were easily, you know, you just easily believed that this guy was your friend or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, we trusted in this character.
You trusted him, and he basically poisoned you,
yeah.
Which made you drowsy and you fell asleep. And he woke up, and he was with his servant, and the servant was like, well, what are we going to do? And he's like, well, we always do. We're going to torture him. And that's how I left
it. And so the first time in my experience, and, you know, I would imagine it's kind of been a trope that's used more than once across role-playing tables across the globe. But, yeah, here we were, like, prisoners and bound and tortured.
Well, you know what's funny? There are no rules for torture.
At least in what
it was 3.5, and I could not find rules for torture, so I had to make rules up because it was just like I was like, oh, he's like, I there's nothing to how do you break someone's will through pain, you know? So
well, at least with that, I would imagine across, you know, other role playing games, or maybe even Pathfinder has stuff. It's one of these things that's like, I wonder if they've shied away from that. For fear of, like, I don't know, backlash.
Just because it has, like, a creepy element to it. I don't know.
I think it was somewhere. Because, I mean, I know they have, like, drowning and starvation and, fatigue and that sort of stuff. It's like, sure, that's equally as suffering, but it's not incurred by another person,
I haven't seen it. I honestly, reading through the rules, I've never seen him go, okay, like, we're going to discuss torture because it's like, but I mean, well, what a place to put your players at.
Yeah.
Like, I'm torturing
and
you.
And I do remember that duality of, like, it never in my budding years of developing as a role player was I so torn between hating and loving my GM. Because it was like, holy shit, how dare you do this to my character? But at the same time, I'm like, this is awesome. I've never been so impassioned and emotional about a circumstance I've been in, and so utterly powerless, but not frustrated, because I guess it just boils down to that bottom line of, like, players trust in their DMs, and DMs should trust in their players.
It was something else, man.
Every dice roll, I was so fueled.
I know, it was great. You were able to escape, but you got caught again. Because you were trying to play it up. You were hamming it up. And then
I was the stereotypical, like, I'm getting tortured, but at the same time, I'm spitting back retorts and insulting his mother, you know, whatever else. I'm just spitting my own blood in his face, you know, just trying to be that bastard. But at the same time, I'm getting the torture even worse than anyone else.
Right, yeah.
So I'm like, okay, this isn't paying off. But it was a memorable experience.
It was, yeah. And I think we've kind of talked about that. It's like we're at that point now where the villain needs to be more predominant.
Yeah.
What's happening. And I think Woofy is really beginning to catch up with that, and we're beginning to see what our villain is. Nibar is still in the game, and we're starting to understand what's going on. But really, honestly, going back and going up Nath level, the scrying is the best. I think that it is time for
it becomes
spying.
That upper level sort of a spell where it becomes more than just enemies, kill them, take their loot, level up. It's like espionage and intrigue and elements that involve more than just obstacles in our path.
And that's what would draw Violet. That's going to draw Violet in
to
be able to get to that point where we're doing the espionage. And your character, I mean, you're at eighth level, you're looking already at what?
Well, I'm looking at more of, like, you know, sure, I've definitely come closer to you, Violet, in this whole unknown realm of the islands. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to adapt your way of thinking.
Mm-mm.
I'm still thinking along the lines of Boddington and my closest friend, Magnus. So this eighth level bump, I'm going to be looking into just, you know what, especially because we just survived this dragon barely.
Right, yeah.
That I'm looking more into big guns sort of a thing. You know, looking into more options for being effective in combat. I think I've spent enough efforts lately into the role-playing sort of a thing.
Yeah.
I get a new discovery. We all get a new ability score bump. And fortunately for me, I get the odd number to an even number, i.e. a bonus bump to my dexterity, which I think is kind of key for Boddington right now. I'll be able to increase my armor class, all the dexterity-based things. It'll be just that much more effective. But then I get a new discovery, too. The one I chose was, there's a number of different abilities you can mix into your bombs. And this one was, I think, from the Ultimate, either the Ultimate Combat or the Ultimate Magic book. It basically has the effects of the confusion spell if you connect on a bomb.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think that would be particularly effective. For a alchemist's bomb, it's 10 plus the intelligence modifier, which is plus 3 for me, plus half the alchemist's level, which will be at 8th level. So it'll end up being a 17 will save, you know, at least in the generic concept of coming up against a bunch of monsters to be able to throw this sort of a thing. And that could really turn the tide, because as I was talking about before with that trippy butterfly, it's that 1 out of 4 chance of you can do whatever you would do. And the 3 other ones are modifications from inflict damage to yourself, attacking the closest thing, to babbling incoherently. That would be the perfect thing to just try to throw in on a bunch of people, monsters, whatever, and have it just create utter chaos.
Yeah.
So that other people can go in there and do their thing.
That would be interesting. So, yeah. But definitely would be great to do against the elves.
Yeah. I know. And that's kind of like, as I'm looking at that going, you know what? For as much as we were foreshadowed and threatened and warned about, you hear these screeches off in the distance and it sounds like a black dragon. Oh, it's a black dragon off in the distance. Okay, it's off in the distance. You know, and it's been, you know, sessions and times and hours and whatever. It's off in the distance. 3 or 4-fold, it's been like, oh, yeah, there's these elves and don't mess with them. Be afraid of these elves. Don't mess with them. It's like, you're foreshadowing the elves more than you have this dragon. So we're gonna
totally get those guys.
I don't know. I mean, I suppose Violet and Boddington are yet to have kind of, I mean, we've kind of like come to a common ground on the elves, but what a particular reaction would be might fluctuate, because we're constantly, at least from our DM, been motivated to kind of fear the elves. But I don't know if violence would be the exact reaction from the gnomes.
Yeah, we're not big in that violence.
Yeah. Well, I just don't think that's my motivation for buffing up all my combat stuff come 8th level.
No, me neither.
Well, let us raise our glasses for a smooth and elegant transition into 8th level.
Yeah.
As we continue on these floating aisles.
Exactly.
I'm Jake.
And I'm Mako.
And this is RPG Afterglow.
Empty glasses.
All right. Yeah. And in case you're still listening, check out the YouTubes. Search RPG Afterglow on the YouTubes.
Oh, yeah.
If you want to see our little gaming table set up, you've made it this far. Episode 22. I mean, come on. I mean, you know, you've earned it. Click the thing that's like RPG Afterglow's intimate look at the gaming table, and you'll get one. Yeah.
Yeah, the cop business is making me go loopy.